Here we are with Richie Neal, my congressman from Massachusetts 1st District. Well, congratulations again, Richie, on being the chairman of this incredibly powerful Ways and Means Committee, and you've explained it. People can go back to WAMC.org and hear what you had to say as we speak yesterday. However, I do want to ask you quickly about Brexit, because you are my expert on things Irish. You are phenomenally well positioned to tell us about this. It all comes down, apparently, to the Irish border, doesn't it?
Well, it's pretty similar to what's happened actually for eight centuries. And I think that another British government is now threatened by what was often described as the Irish question. And part of the success of the Good Friday Agreement, which is now 20 years old, was the elimination of the border between the Republic of Ireland and the north of Ireland. It was cemented in what is known as Strand 2 of the Good Friday Agreement, in which the idea of building institutions north and south would occur between Belfast and Dublin. With the decision of the United Kingdom to leave European Union, one of the most pressing questions is the following: what to do about the border? And Theresa May has been flummoxed time and again, as she's attempted now for the fourth time to find an accommodation that would make sure that there is no border for the purpose of collecting customs and tariffs, and while simultaneously trying to keep a very small number of people in her own party, plus a political party in the north of Ireland called the Democratic Unionist Party, which tend to be hardliners, in place to keep her government from falling. Now, the interesting dilemma about this is the following: that the people in the north of Ireland, like the people in the rest of the United Kingdom, so the majority of people in the in London and in Scotland, they voted to stay in European Union. Wales and most of the mainland, they voted to leave. But 56% of the people in the north voted to stay. So what to do about a customs border between the north and the south is the challenge, and a interesting concept has been developed called a backstop. And the backstop essentially would say that you did not need a hard border, which for all of us would be anathema after the success of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought to an end almost 800 years of battling. So I suspect that European Union, I've met with the European Commission, I've met with Juncker, the head of the European Union, and they have all had the same conclusion, and that is, they will not negotiate the border issue with the United Kingdom. And as Theresa May goes back to Brussels, I believe, in the next day or so, she's going to be looking for some room from them. They have remained intransigent in terms of adjusting that border. And I must tell you, I agree with European Union on that issue.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. I'm very naive about this, but you're the expert. So let me ask you this. Is there a pathway forward as a result of what's going on here to reunification of the two islands?
Well, I think they're closer to it than they've been before. And part of the, part of the intransigence of some of the unionists in the north who want to maintain a relationship with the United Kingdom is based upon what they fear now would be a border with the Irish Sea. And their request to the British government is they want to leave European Union, even though most of the people where they live don't. And in the case of Theresa May, she has said, well, we want to accommodate them remaining in the United Kingdom, but we don't want a hard border. And they're saying, well, if you don't have a hard border, then conceivably that would mean if you had a Norway-type relationship between the North and the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom, which, by the way, is plausible in terms of a customs union, then all of a sudden the border might become the Irish Sea. And that's what the hardline unionists fear. If the border is the Irish Sea, that you're closer to Irish unification than you've been since 1922.
So how many hardline unionists are left? I mean, somebody
that's really fascinating, because the problem is that there are only 10 of them that serve in the British Parliament in the House of Commons, but the difficulty is that Theresa May's government rests upon those 10 votes.
Wow.
And so her ability to bargain here to keep her government afloat is very, very limited, but she turns to them and she will say to them, well, can you give me any room? And they say no. And then she goes back to European Union and says, will you give me any room? And they say no. So there have now been three substantive votes in the House of Commons, and while the margins have narrowed, and she's been positioned to live another day in terms of political survival, the question still remains what to do about that border. It's the last issue, and I think it's unlikely that European Union is going to concede anything to the United Kingdom. And if anything, I think what has happened here is that the support of European Union for making sure that that border is never returned is now universal.
Educate me some more. There are certainly more Catholics in Northern Ireland than there are Protestants, aren't there?
No, it's headed toward parity.
Uh-huh.
It's probably closer. It's headed toward about 50-50, and that's another issue that the unionists now worry about. They think that they would be subsumed into a theocracy, which I think is really nonsense.
Of course it's nonsense. It's nonsense when they said it about electing John Kennedy president.
Exactly, and I think that that's their argument, and they adhere to that old position. But what's interesting about it is the economics on the island have worked very well because of European Union. So you have unionist farmers in the north who agree with the Irish government in the Republic of Ireland, and that is keep the border open because they sell their dairy products in the Republic of Ireland, and they sell them across the United Kingdom, and they don't want to limit their economic opportunities on the entire island. The difficulty is, I mean, I think one of the parts of the genius of what happened with the Good Friday Agreement was that if you wanted to say in the north of Ireland that you were Irish, hallelujah. If you wanted to say that you were English, hallelujah. That was the idea, that you would try to eliminate some of those suspicions and barriers. But again, the notion would be if you grow the economy enough, that opportunity would take care of many of those differences.
Let me switch to a subject which a lot of people are looking at you about, and that is whether or not you're going to subpoena Donald Trump's tax returns.
Well, I've been very meticulous in my choice of words, as you know, and I use two words all the time, which I'll use with you, and that would include the idea that we intend to be methodical and we intend to be judicious, but we intend to ask for those returns. And I think that this is a legal case. It is likely to go on for a long period of time. It is likely to make its way through the federal court system. This dates to a 1924 law, and it has never been used. Every president since Gerald Ford has voluntarily released their tax forms. And indeed, Richard Nixon asked the Joint Tax Committee of Ways and Means and the Finance Committee to review his tax forms in the midst of controversy. So I think here that what we're trying to do is to lay out a case, and much of this will be done privately because, in fact, it is going to be a court case. And I don't know any attorney that would say that you should argue the court case before it's ready.
Well, the American people are very interested in those tax returns, that's for sure. We want to know about involvement with the Russians. We want to know about, you know, whether or not he's a billionaire and that he claims and all the rest.
Well, I also think it's based on two things that he said during the course of his campaign. One, he said he intended to release them. And then two, he said he could not release them because he was under audit. And neither of which have proved to be accurate.
Not true. I love talking to Richie Neal. I could do it all day long. Richie Neal is the congressman from my home district, Massachusetts 1st District. He's been in office since 1989. I don't think 1989 is a particularly early time, Richie, but apparently people who are younger than I disagree with me.
I know the emotion.
It's great to talk to you, Richie.
Thank you, Alan.
We'll be back one more time. Thank you so much.